Hey, it's Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy on Resonance 104.4.
Hey, Max Kaiser. We did a Kaiser Report hangout on Google Plus. What did you think of that?
Oh, it was really fun, wasn't it? Up there in Camden, we had fun.
Well, if you don't know what a Google Plus hangout is, it's basically a live broadcast, and then you could embed it as a YouTube just afterward. But so, yeah, it was a streaming live, basically Kaiser Report, Resonance, Truth About Markets, 104.4 FM sort of thing. And we received hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments and people sending in tweets and asking us questions live. So it was really exciting to have the immediacy and no editing, no post-production, no any of that stuff. We just get to speak straight, raw to the population. And I think this is kind of, you know, a sign of where we're going in the future, because, of course, this is a new technology, a new, obviously not technology, but a way of a service being provided by Google that could alter the live broadcasting experience.
Yeah, well, the format is, we did that for Phoenix TV, which is English-speaking Chinese. We set up a show like that, where it's one camera, you and I, pretty much exactly as the Google Plus. And but unfortunately, we haven't yet set that show up. But that was, I forget what we called that show. It wasn't On the Edge. It wasn't Kaiser Report. Do you remember the name of it? What were we calling that?
On Air or something like that. On Air with Max and Stacy, or Backstage with Max and Stacy. In Control with Max and Stacy.
Oh, in Control, yeah. Well, the other thing is you had Max and Stacy kind of equal billing, which is good because the Kaiser Report doesn't have that element necessarily, which, you know, it's I think that the Google Plus, you had Max and Stacy, and I think that's more of what we do anyway. Who knows where it'll go?
Speaking of media content, I saw the trailer for Chunky Mark, the Artist Taxi Driver's new film coming up. He releases it October 4th. Max features quite heavily in the trailer, and it's this is not a recession. It's a robbery. It looks really exciting, actually.
It looks really good. I think it's exciting. You know, it was crowdfunded. Chunky Mark raised, I think, 11,000 or 12,000 pounds, and it's an hour and or 2 hours and 10 minutes long. And he's got lots of interviews in there, some anime, and. So I think it looks. He's got Frankie Boyle is a big part of the film. So it looks exciting.
Well, he says this is not a recession; it's a robbery, and this kind of makes sense that this weekend, because Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, certainly the richest investor, and he came out and said that the Fed is the greatest hedge fund in the world. Now you've heard that here, of course, as well, and we've had many guests who have said. Who've compared the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, the Central Bank of America, to a hedge fund. But we've said it as an insult. Apparently, Warren Buffett thinks this is a compliment. He said that, you know, the Fed has made so much money off its money printing, off of buying bonds as part of this quantitative easing process. What are your thoughts on this, Max?
Well, the hedge fund, the Federal Reserve is... It's a private institution. It's not a government institution. It's called the Federal Reserve Bank, just like Federal Express is called Federal Express, but it's not a federally government institution. It's a private corporation. Same thing with the Federal Reserve Bank. It's a private institution made up of private banks, and they are looking to make money as a private corporation and a private bank. And as a hedge fund, they can engage in, it's unregulated, just like other hedge funds, and they can engage in things like, if you looked at Zero Hedge, they had a story about how the action in the market just a second before the news of the non-taper was announced from the Fed showed that there was huge insider trading. And that insider trading is coming from the Fed itself, because the Fed knows it's about to make an announcement that will move markets. So it's put trades on that it knows will... benefit from moving those markets. They claim that it's important for the Fed to make money to pay off all the debt that they assumed from all the bankers who committed all the fraud and had to pay civil fines, etc. They've got $4 trillion, close to $4 trillion in debt now, up from $800 billion just a few years ago. And so in the name of paying off this debt, they are licensed to steal and do so as a hedge fund for private bankers. So everyone associated with this fund is walking away with hundreds of billions of dollars in cash. And unfortunately, it's also generating massive austerity around the world. So whether it's the neo-Nazi movement in Greece or the food stamp riots in America, that's the unfortunate consequence.
Well, regarding that story about insider trading, MaxKaiser.com also covered it. So this was a very interesting story. It came from Nanax. And now Nanax is a firm which provides data relating to trading patterns and trading actions happening to the millisecond. And of course, this is very important nowadays because high frequency trading can execute multiple trades in the matter of a millisecond or two. So what Einstein's theory of relativity and the speed of light and things like that, they prove that there was indeed insider trading the day the Fed surprised the markets with announcements that they were not going to taper. So how he saw this was the fact that it takes the amount of time it takes for news to travel on the wire from Washington, D.C. to New York City based on the speed of light, so it can't go any faster than this, is 5 milliseconds. It takes 7 milliseconds to get to Chicago, and it takes a little bit longer than the speed of light just because of that it gets diverted. It's not a straight line to go there. So that's the soonest after the Fed utters the words that a trade could possibly be executed. But in fact, there were trades executed 2 milliseconds before that. Mm-hmm. Possible physical possibility that they could have received the news. It would have been physically impossible. Massive trades executed on especially they looked at gold and GLD. So those are where that's their evidence that there was insider trading. Somebody was executing trades before it could have physically been possible for them to receive the news.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's so there's your proof, and the motive is to make money. And the method is as you've just described it. So the huge gap between the top and the bottom in the economy is engineered by these folks, and you know, the Fortune 400 list of billionaires grew faster than ever in history, and the number of people suffering from poverty and austerity also grew to historic proportions. So these two things are completely related. I think it's a shame that major media, BBC in this country and other outlets around the world, don't make the connection. They don't see any connection between violence and riots and austerity and council tax and bedroom tax issues and the high frequency trading hedge fund that insider trading that goes on at the central bank level. They don't make that connection, which is too bad.
Well, the other thing, of course, is you mentioned that the Fed has close to $4 trillion in assets on its books, and this is or liabilities, which are all these debts that have been transferred from Wall Street banks to the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, you know, this is the business of hedge funds, of course. A lot of these were on the books of, say, Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan because they were doing deals with their best clients, which are the hedge funds. So hedge funds are the best clients of the banks, which is why the banks could give up basically traditional banking and just deal in these fraudulent products that the hedge funds were packaging and selling to pension funds and other passive investors and chumps across the world. So now they have all these dodgy packages of, you know, collateralized various debt obligations. And, you know, they have a lot of sway in what Congress does, for example, in privatizing Social Security. So how are they going to offload this garbage onto the American population? Because that's basically the business of hedge funds, is offloading garbage.
Right. Well, how do they externalize the risk, which is how you make money these days, is you need to externalize the risk. It's not about making money as you people envision the idea of making money, that you work and you make money, or you come up with a good idea that is a profitable idea. That's not how money is made these days. The money is made these days by eliminating risk. So if you put on 10 trades into your fund and you simultaneously hedge those 10 trades, reducing your risk to zero or near zero, and wait for one of those 10 trades to be profitable, and you've made 10 trades, and they're all basically, they could be all in one direction, or they could be in two different directions. There could have been massive trades on various outcomes. But the key is you need to eliminate all of your risk. And when interest rates are close to zero, then the cost of hedging these positions is also zero. That's when, okay, now going forward, one of those 10 trades makes money, could make a little money, could make a lot of money, but you book that as a profit, and you're making money risklessly. That's the key. The key is not to make money because of adding value. The key is making money by eliminating risk. But this is only available for a certain class of people who are able to, through political connections and through Wall Street connections, do business without any risk. Everyone else has a risk. You know, if you're driving a cab out there on the street, you might crash your cab. That's a risk. You know, you would then have a downtime where you're not driving. Your insurance would be adjusted. You could be injured. You know, this is the risk of doing the business. If you're a hedge fund operator, you sit in a cushy office, you put on 10 or 15 trades, you wrap them around various hedging products, that, and you just wait, and the money pours in. So the Federal Reserve Bank just sits there and collects money all day. They don't take any risk. If they need to somehow equalize certain inflationary and deflationary forces in the economy, they can, for example, start a war and send a few thousand kids overseas and to their death. That's a deflationary force to offset the inflation of having riskless trading all day. And what's America done in the last 10 years? Oh, let's see. They've started 10, 12 wars.
So this week, you know, part of this whole story that we're talking about here and why Warren Buffett said that the Fed is the greatest hedge fund in the world is because Ben Bernanke decided not to taper, despite all this talk that he was going to taper, so reduce the number of purchases of bonds every month. Right now it's $85 billion. Well, it's going to continue to be $85 billion a month. So why all of the propaganda? Why all the heavy, heavy media attention to the fact that he was going to taper? And this taper talk, of course, began almost precisely, you know, at the same time that gold smashed down in April. So I think they started saying they were going to be able to taper right around that same time. Do you think there's any connection?
Yeah, well, I wrote about that for a blog, which is an RT, that working as a giant hedge fund, if you know that you're about to announce that you're not going to taper, then gold would shoot up to $2,000 and above. So you have to use your tricks as a hedge fund manager to smash the price of gold, which they did. Then they announced non-taper. Then gold rallied $55, but it rallied $55 from a much lower base that was engineered much lower. So that, imagine if the $55 or $200 rally came if gold was at 1800, it would have rallied $200 and now it would be over $2,000. So, but because they've been manipulating the price for few years, it rallied $55 from a much lower base. It didn't hit a new all-time high in dollar terms. So therefore, the Fed can make put out a statement like there's no inflation, even though price of gas, price of food, the actual price of things people pay at the end of the month is 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% higher than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. That doesn't, it's not calculated by the Fed. So they can say, look at the price of gold. There's no inflation, even though people are having their purchasing power collapse. Wages are down and prices in real terms are absolutely going higher at very, very sharp rates of inflation. So it's part of that propaganda that you see. And they do a really good job. I mean, Warren Buffett is the main beneficiary of all this. He's the second richest man in the world now, right behind Bill Gates. So the U.S. has taken over the top list of the richest folks in the world. Buffett, of course, is an inveterate beneficiary from this insider trading and market manipulation. And that's true.
Yeah, well, there you go. And, you know, of course, a lot of it is about the propaganda is for the purpose of creating in the population's mind the faith and trust, or at least not to have a lack of trust in the managers of your life and your currency, which is the dollar. Even if you live in the UK, it's the dollar. So, you know, I think it's all about perception management. And I, you know, as part of this war machine, you see how very amazingly excellent they are. When you're not part of the matrix, it looks so obvious and you could just see them controlling the sheep to go this way or that way. And I've been thinking of that in the last week because, one, I saw like the UN reported on North Korea and they said, you know, those massive gulags that you could see from space, from satellites. They're saying the stuff that is going on in those gulags is as bad as anything that happened in the Nazi concentration camps. And yet, when I go to Twitter, I expected shrieks and the angst and the passion and the, you know, the urging of action that we see from anything that anywhere that Tony Blair happens to want to bomb, whether it's Libya. There was so much angst and concern and care for those people on the ground. We need to save them. That bizarrely always coincides exactly with what the few oligarchs who control the military industrial complex, for example, what they want. The people on Twitter always have the exact same humanitarian, urgent, passionate desire. They have no concern for North Korea. Today, a Turkish artist, a pianist, his sentence was confirmed for 10 months in prison for retweeting a poem that was considered blasphemous. No angst for him, no screeches like we had for Pussy Riot. Nobody cared about him. So it's like, it is so easily, especially with modern technologies and social media, to just trigger any sort of reaction from a from enough percentage of the population to cause any action you want.
Well, it's understandable that people act in their own self-interest, and that's true even when they're acting in a way that they would consider altruistic. So people's altruism as it relates to some of those items you mentioned, I mean, the Syrian, the false flag Syrian gas attack, for example, there was an outcry about this from people who were expressing some kind of altruism toward their fellow humans. But it's, as you point out, it's they're acting in their self-interest, because if there was any altruism, they would respond to concentration camps and gulags in North Korea, where, I mean, North Korea is a very populated country. So how many people have died or will die in North Korean concentration gulags? 6 million or more? Probably. And yet there's no there's not really a fig of care given. So people act in their self-interest. And so knowing this, it's easy to manipulate somebody who's acting purely in their self-interest. If you put salt down on the ground in front of a slug, it will follow that salt trail. That's if you put a bag of dog food in front of a dog, it will eat all the dog food. If you put a half-naked woman in front of a horny male, they will follow the half-naked woman. People are hardwired to respond. So the thing about organized governments is that they try to mitigate the core instincts, the base instincts of the individual by developing a group commonwealth goal like democracy, something that the Greeks thought about. And then they develop institutions to make that the goal of the group. And it was a really good idea, and it has the US certainly had that for a while, and it was interesting, but it broke down. So you don't really have any democratic institutions or democratic countries anymore. You have thugs and gulags and thieves, and they have organized a kleptocracy, and those kleptocracies are now at war, and they use modern warfare, modern techniques, modern financial techniques, and there's a lot of social unrest that would naturally go with that.
Well, this is a classic Leo Straussian sort of ideas, and Tony Blair really kind of embodies the notion of Leo Strauss to me. Leo Strauss thought the elite should rule by deception for the good of the stupid masses. And a good tool to control them, he said, was religion. But I think And we do see that across huge swathes of America where there's religious fundamentalism is, I mean, it's very similar to, parts of Afghanistan under control of the Taliban. But obviously with a little bit more of a, glossy Western sheen. But I think, technology and modern means of receiving information have also allowed this sort of control where, I mean, when we formed the Republic of America, which is now called a democracy, because whatever enough of the population wants, all must have. And of course, we founded America as a republic to avoid the fact that people do in masses flock like sheep easily and can be led down any disastrous path. Well, we don't have the republic anymore, but we have the democracy, because, just as was predicted by the founding fathers of America, as they're called, is that if, you didn't have a strong, robust media, if you didn't have real thinking and challenging and ideas challenged, now we just receive in an ADHD sort of way, lots of information that trigger. Remember, and the NSA is very involved in all of these networks. They trigger emotional, simple, amoeba-like emotional responses in the population. They're designed to do so.
Yeah, well, in the U.S., you can—I would call it the tragedy of the Second Amendment, which is tragically got people in America to abandon every right that they have under the Constitution to fight for the Second Amendment, the right to own a gun. And in so doing, they're going to lose all their rights, and then in the end, they'll lose the right to own a gun as well. So. That's the tragedy of the Second Amendment, is that people have equated personal freedom and personal rights with owning a gun. But that's just one minuscule part of the architecture of the documents that are the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. It's not the Declaration to own guns, the Constitution to own guns, and the Bill of Rights to own guns. But in America, that is the way that all of these documents are perceived. It's just let's call it 1/100th of weight of importance versus all of everything else in those documents. But unfortunately, because people are stupid, I mean, that's the bottom line. Because you hold a gun, it has physical bullets and it makes a loud noise. It goes bang, and the bullet comes out going rapidly and it hits other people and they fall to the ground. Boom. It's a very simple concept that even a freaking 2-year-old can understand. And so they think that freedom equals gun. It's just very simple to see that in your brain. It's just like if you're a wolf out in the wolf pack, you see lamb equals dinner. You don't think about it so much. You're hungry. You go lamb, lamb, dinner, dinner. Then you, in America now, it's gun, gun, freedom, freedom. Unfortunately, the tragedy of the Second Amendment now is going to lead to a collapse of all U.S. democratic institutions, massive corruption in Congress, massive insider trading, massive wealth confiscation. The entire Bill of Rights is being destroyed, except for the gun rights. The Constitution is shredded. It's complete. You have a woman who runs Yahoo saying that it was, treason, that if she didn't comply with the NSA to give them backdoor entrance to Yahoo to spy on people. I mean, imagine, if that was Benedict Arnold's defense during the Revolutionary War in America, that, well, the British told me that it would be treasonous if I didn't inform on the on the colonists, and then he would have given a big fat wet kiss from George Washington and a $50 billion reward. I don't think so.
Well, you bring up a point there about the gun, and I can relate it to what happens across the economy as well. So I got into a Facebook dispute with my cousin, who insists that the problem with the American economy is all those welfare cheats, that these people collecting food stamps, 100% of them, he said, 100%. Are frauds, they're cheats, and they're defrauding the government. Very few of them, he said, really, really need it. They just need to get a job. Now, the average food stamp recipient receives, I think, is $1.27 per meal. And yet I showed him about 15 articles about JP Morgan from just the last year or two, and most of them in the last 2, 3 months. Of crime after crime after crime after crime after crime after crime they keep on committing. And he said, well, look, they paid a $1 billion fine here. That's restitution enough. I said, even if they stole $100 billion and they're just giving back $1 billion. So to him, $1 billion, the billion is a mesmerizing, huge word. And he can't tell the difference between $1 billion and $500 billion or $1 trillion. He can't tell the difference. It's just a big word that he cannot possibly understand in any sort of context. But the food stamps of $1.27 for the meal, the $1.27 free meal, free lunch the guy got, enrages him in a way that is that because he can understand it. Now, the same with these guns is like people have a hugely passionate relationship to this AK-47 or their AR-15 or their Colt 44. They think they're very powerful because it feels when they shoot it at a gun range, it feels so mighty and powerful, and they feel like a man, and their testicles are bigger. Everything is like stronger about them. And yet, the U.S. military industrial complex has been practicing on populations around the world all sorts of weapons that can just evaporate you in a fraction of a second. While you might have a grenade launcher on your back, two AR-15s in the two hands you only have, and that's it. And they just evaporate you as you're sitting there taking on the government at your home, at your compound. It's like it's so mind-blowingly different that the fraud of the scale of $1 trillion taken by JP Morgan to the fraud that could possibly, even if it was 100% fraud in the food stamp market, it's a fraction of what is being defrauded in the financial markets. The same here. It's like that. It's a thing of scale, and people just don't understand.
Well, they have a slave mentality or a prison mentality. You know, if you're, let's say you're in prison, there's a bunch of people in prison with you, and the warden of the prison who works for the private prison contractor has decided to reduce the amount of oxygen that they're going to allow into the prison and reduce the food being served in the prison. And you're in your cell, and you notice that it's getting harder to breathe, and you're losing weight really fast. But the guy you share a prison with stole one of your cigarettes. So, what is your immediate priority? You don't really think there's not much you can do about the air being cut off or the food being cut off and your rapid weight loss. There's nothing you can do about it, you think. But you can get angry about the guy who stole your cigarette. So you make it a big issue. You fight with this guy, and you're going to fight for your right for that cigarette because you've got rights in the prison. You've got rights as a slave, and it's not right that the man took your cigarette. And so, okay, America, there the oxygen's being depleted essentially through environmental catastrophes like the BP Eco Holocaust in the Gulf of Mexico. The food's being cut off through the diminishment of food stamps. You know, the food stamp program was cut sharply.
Well, the Congress voted to cut it, and the Senate has to agree, but the Senate won't.
Yeah, on the same day as they did quantitative easing.
Yeah.
So, but your neighbor has a gun, so now you want a gun, or your neighbor got robbed, stole your cigarettes, and so you're all upset about it. So it's a mentality. There was a shift in the American psyche at some point where they just shifted over toward, there was a polarization in the psyche where they think as prisons. They have a slave mentality, which is, you know, you always you become the thing that you hate. And America throughout its history has been full of hatred. It's they hated the indigenous population, so they committed genocide. They hated the slaves that they imported from Africa, so they, you know, tried to kill them all. Now they have become the very thing that they hate. They are a slave nation. It's a slave mentality of slaves, and you see it played out with this pettiness over gun issue when the entire institution of the country itself is being flushed down the toilet.
Yeah, well, so anyway, the most Second Amendment fundamentalists, anyway, that I hear, they talk about, they really seem to passionately believe, just like many liberals passionately believe, we need to invade so country after country that happen to also be in oil-rich regions. They really passionately believe that they're helping those people. Their intentions are pure and good. They really believe it, and the same with these people who really believe that their, you know, semi-automatic weapon is going to protect them from tyranny. You know, if they were actually demanding and getting change through Congress, forcing through, if the NRA was like forcing legislation that allowed communities or populations to have tactical nukes and you know, missiles and their own F-16s, because that's what you would need to fight tyranny. I mean, just look at Fallujah. Those guys were heavily armed, Al-Qaeda there, the sort of jihadis and well, local citizens were very well armed. Those people were annihilated, and their babies are still being born with the highest birth defect rate in the world, thanks to the, you know, the tactical nukes, the depleted uranium and white phosphorus we dropped on them. But there are people fighting back, and Latin America is the real home of like some really interesting stuff. Now, here's a remarkable headline from this week. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff calls off U.S. trip. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has called off a state visit to Washington next month in a row over allegations of U.S. espionage. The U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, has been accused of intercepting emails and messages from Ms. Rousseff, her aides, and state oil company Petrobras. The allegations were based on documents leaked by fugitive former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden. President Barack Obama had promised to investigate the incident. This is like a remarkable thing compared to, say, the response from all these European nations who pretend that they're shocked, pretend to their local domestic populations that they had no idea. We had no idea about all of this, and express outrage, but then know that the attention span of the average person is until the Miley Cyrus starts twerking. You know, here's a principled stance that may cost the nation, but they're taking this principled stance.
I'm surprised you don't see more countries take a principled stance in the wake of this corporate espionage that's gone on in the U.S. spying on everyone, Brazilian oil companies. I mean, just like America would go into the Middle East and rape and pillage Iraq for oil. Brazil is a huge oil country, and the NSA and the Edward Snowden memo proves that they engage in corporate espionage, which is a different, different form of rape and pillage. And so Brazil has responded in the interest of the country. So the leader of Brazil is acting in the interest of her country instead of the interest of the banking guys. I'm curious, it's funny that Germany has been so approving of this spy scandal, given their history. I think that they've just been so beaten down after World War II to accept every little thing that comes their way from the US and the UK and Israel that they just have no ability to stand up for themselves anymore. That's too bad.
Well, I think it's two things. Deutsche Bank is number one. And, if they realize that the US has intercepted everything, just presuming for that Germany's not involved actually in enabling these backdoors, which I'm sure they are. Okay. Deutsche Bank, so they know every single one of these, this thing could take down the entire German economy with all their toxic, fraudulent derivatives. Then the second is the population. The domestic population is, primarily concerned with creating wealth with real jobs. You couldn't fob off on them, a nation of Walmart workers. They wouldn't do that. They need to have somebody that they could see producing wealth, manufacturing wealth. So I think, she probably fears like some sort of trade deal or trade war or something like that, which prevents Germans from manufacturing.
Well, you're saying that the Volk, the people, are fat and happy. This was when the era, remember going back 60 or 70 years, another leader created the Volkswagen as part of the effort to make the people in the country happy and complacent while the government was involved in nefarious activities. Is Merkel any different? If she's completely open to allowing the American Stasi to spy on her people, in the interest of keeping the people in the country, the Volk, happy and stupid. Interesting parallels there.
Well, that's what I'm saying is like this whole thing, all of these back doors were allowed by all of the corporate CEOs of all of these companies, whether it's Apple or Google or Microsoft. And all of them did it because they thought it was for the greater good. Everybody who did it in Nazi Germany thought they weren't told, we're going to spy on all these, our domestic population in order to crush them should they ever rise up. No, it was to protect them from, devilish people. Well, this is the same thing. We think we're protecting them from devilish terrorists and all these horrible things out there. We're just protecting them. And they seem to genuinely believe it. I don't know if this is a process of cognitive dissonance and they're just trying to get through their day, resolve issues in their brain, in their psychology. This is just a thing they maybe really truly believe that they're doing it for your own good. We're trying to help you. I didn't mean for this to turn into a concentration camp where we were incinerating you. I didn't, that wasn't my intention. That's what they'll say one day at the Nuremberg-like trials if we ever survive.
Well, it's propaganda and scapegoating, which has been proven effective in the past. So the technology companies that are spying and whose market capitalizations are in the, record highs of $300 billion, $400 billion, they're doing so in an environment that to some degree is still a zero-sum game. I mean, the Earth's carrying capacity for GDP growth is finite. We don't live in in an environment where you can create copies of planet Earth indefinitely with all of the natural resources that come with those with Earth. That is still the basis of the all economic activity that everyone is a part of. So it's a somewhat, confined environment. It's a zero-sum game. Technology companies are the highest and biggest capitalized companies in the world, and then of course the banks that work within them and work on these high-tech, high-frequency trading algorithms. So for that to occur, for that wealth to be aggregated in that way, you need propaganda and scapegoats. So the scapegoats are, let's see, there's the poor. The poor, of course, in the UK are being scapegoated, and the poor in America are being scapegoated. They're being put into prisons. Their rations are being cut, and there's millions and millions of folks in these prisons, and it's interesting to contemplate where that's going, because the prices, if inflation, think about this, inflation is starting to break out. The quantitative easing is not working. The taper is not coming. The printing must continue. Price oil is at $110 a barrel. The all-time high was 147. Let's say in the next year or two it breaks that, it goes to $200 a barrel, and now the price of everything is double where it is today or triple where it is today. That means the price of maintaining these prisons is very, very high. The food that goes into the prisons, there's you can substitute food in the prisons, and go to some kind of genetically modified gruel that you're dishing out. 14 ounces a day, that you figured out, as was done in prisons in the past, the minimum calorie intake that can keep a person alive for 24 hours, and then that starts to get degraded. So now you have these huge prisons of people who are starving to death, and also they're doing work. They're doing work for 5 cents an hour, 10 cents an hour. This is another trend in America. The ability to use prison labor by commercial enterprises has now been reversed, the law that prevented it. Now they can do it. So you have people, let's see, they're working 20 hours a day and they're starving to death. And the crimes that they committed were they objected to what the state was doing. So it's a crime of a censoring crime or a politically, they're political prisoners. Working 20 hours a day and starving to death. I'm trying to remember. Has that ever happened before? This is totally original. It's never happened before. Gosh, it can't possibly happen. It's never happened before.
Well, there's a remarkable story that was printed in Salon.com yesterday. And this is remarkable. Okay, I'm going to read you the headline: Elite's Strange Plot to Take Over the World. A few decades ago, politicians hatched a Tom Friedman-esque idea to unite U.S. and Western Europe. But then they end, did it succeed? Because later in the story, they ask, isn't this NSA sort of spying? Isn't that a one-world government? Aren't they? Don't they have a backdoor into every single government on Earth? Well, it sounds a lot like Alex Jones's New World Order. So he says, Western elites in America and Western Europe, after World War II, made a serious effort to get rid of nations altogether and combine, quote, all freedom-loving peoples into one giant, quote, Atlantic Union, a federal state built on top of the NATO military alliance. As odd as it sounds, the documentary evidence is clear. This movement did manage to create a European Union, which came from the same ideological wellspring as the Atlantic Union. Once we recognize that the Cold War saw the construction of a powerful international regime that explicitly sought to get rid of sovereign nations. These broad security architectures revealed by the Syria situation and the NSA spying revelations make a lot more sense. So, like, he's even, they go on to talk about 1971. There was a hearing in the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Representatives. They convened a hearing to discuss the prospect of combining the United States of America and Western Europe into one country. This Atlantic Union would be a federal union very similar to the one described in the U.S. Constitution. Existing countries would become states under a federalist system, with a larger federal system having its own currency, military, interstate commerce, regulation, and foreign relations apparatus. Now, I wonder, so that seems to be the last hearing, 1971. And then, of course, later in 1971, that's when we went off the gold standard. And that became... That's what I've always said to when Alex Jones says, oh, there's going to be a new world order. And I always say that the dollar is this new world order. It controls everything. Everything. Like I said earlier, even if you're British, you have the dollar. The dollar is your currency.
Yeah. So how do they sell it at the top? They say this is appealing to all what kind of people? Freedom-loving people?
Freedom-loving people. This is what the politicians post-World War II were saying. We need to get rid of nations. They actually, at the time, were openly saying we need to get rid of nations because nations are the cause of all these wars.
Mm-hmm. And so the appeal to the individual is that they are freedom lovers, mm-hmm. and that this is a new institution that will encourage freedom, right?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that there are a lot of freedom movements in America that are called liberty or freedom movements.
Mm-hmm. So it's a huge centralized authority,
yes.
that covers Europe and the United States in the name of freedom. So it's an autocratic, huge autocratic, centrally governed institution that promotes freedom, they say. So now, how does the individual get hoodwinked into thinking that a all-powerful, centrally organized, centrally banked, autocratic entity is going to work in the interest of freedom? How are people hoodwinked into this? I think it has to do with people's definition of freedom. For example, What is your definition of freedom out there in Radio Land? What you're free to do? What, how would you answer that question? What are you free to do? If you are free, what are you free to do? Well, I think a lot of people equate freedom with the freedom to do nothing. You know, this is why people end up buying into technology. Remember, technology was sold over the decades as you will have the freedom to do nothing. Because the machines will do everything. And the idea, the utopian future that was sold by technologists 50 years ago and 20 years ago, or even with the iPhone, is that with this technology, you don't have to work more than 5 hours a week or 1 hour a week. You're free to do nothing. And I think people, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, are sucked in by this notion that their freedom to them means freedom to do nothing. I think that real freedom is freedom to compete. That's what people want to be able to do. They want to be able to compete freely. That's freedom. Compete freely is freedom. You can compete without being... corralled into prisons or being subjected to the tyranny of an oligarchy or a kleptocracy. That is curtailing your freedom to compete. If you look in nature and people say, oh, look at the birds and the lions and the tigers and the polar bears. They're free. They're so free. Look at the fish. They're free. Yes, they're free to compete. You know, if these animals stop competing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for food, they die. So that's their freedom. They're free to compete, but it's nature is so equally balanced that there's an equality there. All of the fish in the school of fish are equally possessing the possibility of eating enough to survive that day. That's their freedom for today. They're not being in a, they're not in a net, and they're being fed fish food from a centrally planned autocrat who happens to like fish number one because that fish is in some way a favored fish. So that fish gets fat and all the other fish die. No, that's not freedom, is it? You may say, well, I'm just in this pen and I don't have to swim all day and look for food. Isn't that better than just being, out there in the open water? No, it's not. In fact, you are again get you get back to that slave mentality, which is a mentality that once it takes hold, it's hard to get rid of. I think people who are on brought up on iPhones, this is the new chain, really. I mean, this is you're born into slavery with this, and but you don't see it because you don't know any other reality. You're born a slave and you have no other reference point. But that's highly profitable. I can't tell you how profitable it is to have a plantation of slaves. I mean, look, if you got, 1.2 billion people on Facebook slaving away for Mark Zuckerberg, oh, who just 5 years ago was a college student picking his nose in a Harvard dorm trying to get laid, and now has more than $12 billion because he's got 1.2 billion slaves giving him money every single day. You're not unhappy with the current situation, I can assure you.
Well, so going back to this New World Order story, this elites ruling the world is, and going with your notion of freedom as competition, is we have this superstructure, but it's untouchable. It's there's no structure to even which to demand accountability. So you have the NSA and the secret spying, which is really corporate espionage and sabotage. So you could be slaving away in your bedroom on your computer, like the GoPro guy was, designing something, and they could just delete it and delete it and delete it and take away and steal all your ideas, transfer it to Mark Zuckerberg or whoever they want, part of their regime. Also, you have these contracts, these trade deals negotiated in secret, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which part of the contract, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you look it up, it's like getting rid of sovereignty. Like you.
Well, sovereignty in this instance means competition.
Yeah.
All these countries, sovereign states, compete. If you go back to David Ricardo, the contemporary of Adam Smith, and he talked about competitive advantage of different countries. It's part of the mercantile system that governed world commerce for hundreds of years under a gold standard that generated a very profitable, equitable world economy. Which is based on free competition. But the central banks are the enemy of this. And in 1913, the central bank finally made it into America after more than 100 years of trying. Even though the country was founded, according to Ben Franklin, as a way to get away from the Bank of England, a central bank, finally made it into the U.S. And 100 years later, you've got a slave nation.
Yeah, but this is, so they talked about the elites, as this article points out. They talked between 1939 and 1971. There were all these conversations about creating one world government, an Atlantic Union. But I think they looked around them and they realized the flaw of this system that the founding fathers had created, this notion of a republic and then a democratic vote within the republic, is that the people could get uppity and they could demand too much stuff. So I think the idea just evaporated. They got rid of the idea. They don't speak about it in public and they just do it. Why create any sort of institutions which people think have some sort of accountability to them? So even like the IMF and the UN, they have buildings, they have general assemblies, they have meetings, they issue reports, and the people read it and they wave it and they say, "This is wrong. This is wrong." But they move the same, they maintain the same notion, and they just go off grid, so you can't possibly know. It's you're the schizophrenic with the crazy ideas that we're doing this. Because everybody seems happy with their Democratic vote, yelling at Angela Merkel or Obama, and they think, oh, we made the wrong choice. We should have chose John McCain instead, as if it would ever make any choice, whoever you're going to elect, because there's another power that's greater than them anyway.
Yeah, well, it's what we've been talking about, the casino gulag. So it's the merging of the Fed and the Golden Nugget, the merging of Washington, Wall Street, and Las Vegas. So in Las Vegas, they know that if people are on the floor at the slot machines drinking, throwing their money away, at some point, if they get too bored with the fact that nobody's winning anything, they will desert that casino and go somewhere else. So the casino simply adjusts the algorithm in the slot machines to start paying off money. The bells go off, the whistles go off, ding, 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 winner, winner, winner. Oh, it's so exciting. Look, Mrs. Putzersflocken from Schnackenflicken just made $10,000. Over the last 20 years, she's given the casino $300,000, but look, she just made $10,000. Oh, my God. This is exciting. And everyone is back doing, you know, pulling the handle of the one-armed bandit, as it's called, and throwing their money away to the casino operator. So here you have, in the casino gulag of the global economy, the American economy, there was a very similar event last week called taper non-taper. So everybody in the casino was afraid and getting bored that, you know, unless the casino adjusts the winning percentage on these slot machines, we're going to abandon the financialized, securitized casino gulag. And we're going to just start buying gold and silver because we know they have value. So Ben Bernanke adjusted the winning ratio in the global slot machine central banking system to be non-taper. Ding, 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 ding. Three cherries, non-taper. Woohoo! Look at that. The stock market rallied 180 points. Oh my God, what do we have? A winner. There was an IPO on Friday of some cybersecurity stock that went up 100% in one day. Remember the dot-com mania of the late 90s when stocks opened up 100%, 200%, 300%? Yay, we have a winner. So this keeps people glued to the casino gulag. Meanwhile, they're losing
30 seconds.
They're losing all their rights, and it's going on.
Okay, well, that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find more about us at maxkaiser.com, and that's it.
Bye, y'all!